So a reminder that we're going to have this one-year anniversary celebration of being here in our center on January 24th. It's a Friday evening. And we'll do it together with doing the installation of the statue that Lorraine Caporel has made for us of Ma Pajapati, the woman who started in a sense started the nun's order of Buddhism. And it should be a lovely evening. We have planned it out very nicely, and it should be somewhat different than what you'd expect. And I think quite lovely. So we hope that a lot of people come. The evening will be done in part to celebrate women in Buddhism, women teachers, women practitioners. So that's built into the installing the statue. And I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. So since we're going to have this celebration of the statue and celebrating women in Buddhism, I thought I would talk a little bit this evening about this woman we're going to enshrine here, the statue of her, and why this is happening, my thoughts about it. And some of it you already know. I think some of it's in the newsletter, some of the ideas of it. But I thought I'd talk more about it and talk a little bit about this particular person. And also, if you know a little bit about who she is and why we're going to install a statue of her here, I think perhaps it'll add a little bit more depth to the ceremony we're going to do. So the woman's name is Maha Pajapati Gotami. Gotami is like a clan's name or family name. It's the same as the Buddha. He was Siddhartha Gautama. And in fact, she was the foster mother of the Buddha. And it worked out this way, that she had a younger sister named Mahamaya, who was the mother of the Buddha. And both Mahapajapati and Mahamaya were married off to the same king, Suddhodana, who was the father of the Buddha. And it was a custom back in ancient times, in the upper classes, I don't know who, but certainly was a custom, as it still is to this day in some places in the world, of multiple marriages and multiple wives. And it was nothing out of the usual that this man had two wives, and the two wives were sisters. And as it turned out, Maha Pajapati had two children herself, a boy by the name of Nanda, and I'm not sure of the woman's name. And Mahamaya gave birth to the Buddha, or the person who was going to be the Buddha, to Siddhartha. And then 7 days after the Buddha was born, his mother died. And some people have pointed out that most of the great religious leaders in human history have lost a parent early in their lives when they're still children. And so the Buddha was like this also. And even though she had two children of her own, Mahamaya took it upon herself then to raise the Buddha, and she nursed him. And had that very strong connection of nursing him and raised him as her own child. And eventually the Buddha went off to engage in his ascetic practices. And then after he became the Buddha, some years after he became a Buddha, he returned to the town of his birth. And there's a whole various stories around what that was like. And by that time, or maybe it was a later visit back home, but at some point his father had died. And the Buddha's father, the king. And Mahapajapati's, her own two children, the son, Nanda, had gone off to become a monk, a disciple of the Buddha. And at this time, when the Buddha visited his home place, he gave a discourse, talked about some things, and a whole bunch of the young men The sutta says 500 decided to go off and become monks, leaving their wives behind. And so here was Mahapajapati. Her husband had died. Her son had gone off and become a monk. And Mahapajapati was kind of like a leader of the type, maybe because she was the wife of the king, of many of the women in that area, who now found themselves without husbands. So what do you do? And this is India, ancient India, where where often your status in society depended a lot on the man you were connected to. And if you had no husband, if you had no father, if you had no no son, then you're kind of adrift in society. And also, I don't know if maybe being kind of been kind of a queen, maybe her own support was guaranteed. I don't know. In any case, she knew the Buddha quite well and had heard his teachings, and perhaps was quite inspired by the possibility of awakening, of becoming free. And as her own circumstances had changed, maybe her responsibilities as a wife was no longer needed, her responsibilities as a parent was no longer needed, she then went to the Buddha and asked if she could be ordained as a nun. There were no nuns at that point. And the Buddha didn't exactly say no. What he said was, enough. Please don't ask this. So she asked again. And you get the impression that she was a very determined, resolved, resolute person. So she asked again, and he said in his way, because maybe he's just not being direct, as some people can be, or who knows why exactly, but he said again, enough, please don't ask this. And a third time she asked, and a third time he said, enough. And then the description says she left crying. And the Buddha at some point then left the hometown and went wandering around India. And she gathered around her this group of somewhat widowed, monastically widowed women. And they all shaved their heads, as a monastic would do, and got rid of all their jewelry and all their fine clothes. And then they put on monastic robes, cloaks of renunciant, robes of renunciant. And they started walking across India. And they walked 150 miles on foot. And perhaps, at least for Mahapajapati, after all, she was a queen. And my guess is that she was not that fit. And she was probably a little bit older and not used to walking a lot. And in the discourses, it explains how she arrived finally, after some time, after walking 150 miles to where the Buddha was. And her feet were all, their legs were all swollen. And their limbs and legs were all covered with dust. And they came to where the Buddha was, and Buddha was staying inside of a building. And they didn't go and find the Buddha. After all, he'd said no three times. And so, but they stood outside, crying. The description is tears streaming down their face. And Ananda, who is the Buddha's kind of main attendant, came out the door one day and saw these women. You know, he knew quite well, because Ananda was also part of the same, I think, clan, maybe a cousin of the Buddha. So he certainly knew Mahapajapati as part of his family and some of these local women. And they were all crying. He said, "What?" And they'd shaved their heads and they were filthy and exhausted and whatever. He said, "What's going on here?" And they said, "Oh, the Buddha will not allow us to become ordained. Will not allow us to become renunciants, to follow a spiritual life, to follow a life pursuing liberation and freedom under him, under his guidance, under his teachings." And so Ananda said, "Oh, well, let me go talk to him." And Ananda so goes into the building, and says to Ananda, says to the Buddha, you know, it would be a good thing if the Buddha would... He's explained what was happening. These women were out there. And said, it would be a good thing if the Buddha would allow women to be ordained. And the Buddha said the same thing. He said, enough. Don't ask this question. So Ananda asks again. And the Buddha says the same thing. And Ananda asks a third time. And the Buddha again says, enough. Don't ask this question. At which point, Ananda doesn't give up, but he decides he has to change tacks, change strategies. So he asks the Buddha, is it not true that women have the capacity of becoming fully liberated, fully enlightened? And the Buddha says, yes, they have that capacity. It's possible for them. And is it not true that Mahapajapati was your foster mother, that she nursed you when your own mother died and raised you as her own child? And the Buddha said, yes, that's true. And then Ananda says, well, then I think it would be really good if you would ordain these women, ordain her. And so he says, then the Buddha said, all right, they can be ordained, provided she can be ordained if she provided she takes these 8 rules. Because monastics have 227 rules so they have to live by. He said, if she lives by these 8 rules, then she can become a renunciant, a nun. And they were, it's very controversial, these rules that the Buddha gave, because the rules had to do with, mostly had to do with rules of basically being subservient to the monks. The rules like, one of the important things in the monastic tradition is that seniority is very important. So, like, if someone was ordained a day before you, an hour before you, you better bow to that monk because he's more senior than you. And so, when monks meet, they always make sure, you know, the date and the time of the ordinations to make sure, you know, who should be bowing to who. And so the Buddha said that no nun, no matter how, even if she's been a nun for 100 years, should be more senior than the most junior novice monk. And no nun should ever admonish a monk or teach a monk. The monks can teach and admonish the nuns. And nuns are always to be ordained. Kind of a joint ordination. There always has to be a group of nuns and a group of monks together in order to make a valid nuns ordination. Whereas monks, they can just, you know, men can just ordain each other if they're monks. But women had required having the male monastics present for that their ordination. And there were 8 rules like that. So they're quite controversial. And then the Buddha said something that, at least in one tradition, we have in other traditions that he didn't say this. He said, if women had not been given the ordination, my dispensation, these teachings that I have, whatever, would have lasted 1,000 years. But now they'll only last 500 years because we've allowed women to be ordained. So anyway, Ananda goes outside and says to Mahapajapati, the Buddha says, he's agreed, you can be ordained, provided you accept these 8 conditions. She says, of course I'll accept them. No problem. She was quite happy about this. And then the Buddha told Ananda, then now you can go out and also ordain and give kind of nun's ordination to all those women who are with Mahapajapati. And they received more formal ordination. Mahapajapati was just enough for her to agree to those 8 conditions. The other nuns, as the tradition says, got a much fuller ordination. And in fact, it was a little bit controversial a few years later where the other nuns said, Mahapajapati wasn't really ordained as a nun. So they had to go back to the Buddha. And he said, no, she really is. And so in a sense, her determination was responsible for the nuns' order. She led these women there and got the whole thing going. She then continued in her own practice, started her practice, and then became fully enlightened, became one of the fully enlightened disciples of the Buddha. realized. We don't have much records of her. There's a famous little discourse where she asks the Buddha a question to give his teachings in brief, and he gives her 8 points by which you know the Dharma. And that's I don't have it with me, but that's a very interesting little teaching. And later she asked some Buddha some other questions, and she got involved in some controversy that happened. So the nuns' order started, and it's been said, I don't know if it's true or not, but it's been said that this was really the first order of women renunciants, nuns, in the history of humankind. And so the Buddha opened the door to women to, in a sense, open the door after saying enough for a few times, for the women to do that kind of life, to live that life. And it's a beautiful life to be a renunciant. It's a beautiful to be able to devote one's full life to the practice and teachings and study and purifying the heart and the mind and realizing our capacity for enlightenment. And then there was for many years, many centuries, a very active and vibrant nuns community in ancient India and Sri Lanka and different places. The records seem to indicate that about 2 to 3 centuries after the time of the Buddha, that was kind of like the probably the peak of that vibrancy. That in the 2nd and 3rd century BCE, before the Common Era, there was lots of records of the nuns being very much involved in the religious life of the times, very active. A lot of nuns existed. A lot of women were ordained. And there was a vibrant tradition of women's literature, championing the possibility of women practicing. And during that time, about 200-300 years after the Buddha, there was a long poem that was created called the Mahapajapati song, I guess. And it was a song or a poem, long one, talking about Mahapajapati. And in that, her status, it gets elevated to be almost equal to that of the Buddha. She's a lot of the ways in which the Buddha is talked about in the classic discourses, kind of very high status, very highly revered as the founder of the religion. Mahapajapati has the same position and deeply honored. And so it's kind of like she held that it's part of the position the Buddha held. For the nuns' community, Mahapajapati held that position. Someone they revered, they tried to emulate, they lived up to, they were inspired by. It was kind of a female role model. So I noticed in the early to mid-90s, 1990s, long before we even dreamed of having a center, that the meditation centers around the country, some of the ones I knew, were beginning to put female imagery, female statues and things, in their meditation halls and in their halls of worship. The San Francisco Zen Center had done it in the 80s, and Spirit Rock was doing it. And I think once I counted in the meditation hall, the old meditation hall at Spirit Rock, there was one guy in the hall, there was this Buddha. And then there were, if you looked around, there were, you know, 4, 5, 6 different images of women. But they were all mythological or archetypical images. They were mostly bodhisattvas from the Mahayana tradition of Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, beings like that. And there was a strong feeling that we needed to have some kind of strong image of a woman as a role model, as a suggestion that women could also practice and inspire women. There's a beautiful story, a beautiful, very touching story. And I recounted this story to someone last week. So I'll back up a little bit and tell you why I recounted it to her. She had gone off to, as a quite a young woman, I'm not sure when, but to Dharamsala, where the Tibetans are in exile, Tibetan government is, and Dalai Lama's there. And she was, I think, very inspired by the Tibetan teaching she received there. But she was very disturbed by the misogynist language that often appeared in the teachings and the texts that she was being she was studying. And so she was just talking about how disturbed she was by that. And then I told her this story. And I think it had to do with Tenzin Palmo, who was been around and now a little bit famous. Some of you might have read her book. In the early 90s, there was a meeting, a conference in Dharmasala with a lot of the more senior Western Dharma teachers of different traditions, Tibetan tradition, Zen tradition, Vipassana tradition. And it was kind of the first time they all met, the different traditions met as teachers, talk about what it's like to be teachers and offer support to each other and do what teachers do when they get together. And at some of those meetings, it lasted for many days. They flew all the way to Dharmasala to meet. The Dalai Lama came and attended, was part of it, and discussed it. And at some point, this Tibetan Westerner who was a Tibetan nun, I think it was Tenzin Palmin, went up to the Dalai Lama in front of everybody and said, "Dalai Lama, I would like to teach you a new visualization." You know, and he said, "Okay." And she said, "You know, close your eyes. And now imagine that you're going to receive teachings from a great, great enlightened teacher. It happens to be a woman teacher. And you come to where the great monastery is, and you walk in, you come into the great hall where the teaching is going to be given. And someone receives you at the door and says, 'Oh, we're so happy to see you. Glad we're here. But please, all the men can sit here in the back of the hall. And of course, you can, you know, practice as well as everybody else, but please sit here in the back.' And then you look around and look at all the paintings and all the walls, and they're all women. And there's a woman teacher up there, and there's a woman statue up there of the great founder of the religion. And she went on that kind of theme, kind of, you know, reversing the role, right? And at some point, the Dalai Lama started to cry. And then he said, 'We have to change this.' He kind of got it, you know, from that kind of what it was like. And in fact, in the 1980s in America, in the circles I was traveling in Buddhism here in California, and I think elsewhere also, there was quite a strong women's movement. There still is a little bit, but it doesn't have the same strength as it, I think, it had in the 1980s. And there were a lot of women gatherings and meetings and conferences, women in Buddhism things, and books were produced. There was a magazine that was back then about women in Buddhism. And I think it was a real need because of the sexism, the gender imbalance that happened in many different ways in the tradition. When I came to Tassajara in 1980, it was just kind of beginning to change there. And there were some women who were really speaking up and said, "You know, this is, you know, women should be allowed to be assigned to be mechanics and plumbers and given positions to be directors." And so slowly, you know, while I was there, Tassajara, very quickly when I arrived, there was this kind of breaking down of the sexual barriers that existed at Tassajara. But, you know, coming out of Asian culture, coming out of American culture, it's not so surprising that Buddhism is influenced by the society and culture it's in. And so sexism of society is part and parcel of its own, you know, of how people organize themselves. So the women's liberation movement and all this made people sensitive to this, and by the 1980s, things were starting to happen. By the mid-80s and late 80s, there were a lot of these big meetings, and then also by the 80s, I think, that was a time also when women were the first time were starting to really become teachers in the Buddhist tradition in the West. And that had, you know, opened up a lot of doors. And this continued somewhat into the 90s, but I don't feel that my sense is that there was a real strong need in the 1980s for that. And my own sense is that there hasn't been much need for that because I don't see a lot of that happening anymore as the way. There's still a little bit here and there, but I don't feel the same strength of it all. I've tried here to encourage women's groups of various types. We had a day long some years ago, and a day long just for women. And invited down one of the Spirit Rock teachers who puts on these kinds of women retreats. And I think it was a very lovely day, as I was told. But the impression I had is, I mean, it didn't seem like there was a lot of, vitality is the right word, but it didn't seem like it was like a strong need. It wasn't like people were like, "Oh, it was great, and let's do it again, and I can't wait." And, you know, it was just like, "Oh, that was, you know, it was nice, we did it." I don't know what to say exactly, but it just didn't, so we, you know, it didn't seem. And then I've tried since then to encourage women's meetings and stuff, and it's a little bit strange for me to be encouraging it. And, you know, I'd like to go, but I can't get myself invited. And but it didn't really seem to have a lot of oomph behind it. So my sense is that the need that existed in the 1980s is not here. I've tried in my role as a teacher to be sensitive to the issue. And for example, you know, I'm kind of a guy. So, you know, I represent men, and for better and worse. And so I try to, for example, when I invite other people to come and teach, I certainly try to have, you know, when I'm gone and things, to have equal number of men and women. My preference is actually try to have more women than men come and be teachers for our group because I'm a man, because I teach here so much. At least that's on my mind. I don't know how well the track record is, but that's, you know, it's a thought of mine. I try to be careful with the language and stories that I use. Some 6-7 years ago, someone told me, "Do you realize that almost all the stories you use and people you quote are men?" So, you know, so thank you. And so I'm sensitive to these things, but, you know, I don't know how well I've managed. I mean, not sensitive enough, I'm sure, but they're rumbling around my mind that I need to be careful. What I feel now in the late 90s and early part of this decade, what's been happening is, so I don't feel that the women's thing is so important anymore. And now you can disagree with me very quickly if you'd like to. But what I feel what's happening now is the same energy, the same interest, the same vitality, and the same speaking up and challenging the status quo is happening around people of color. And that's maybe an unfortunate word, but that's kind of the word that self-selected word by a certain group of people. Most of people in American Buddhist circles like we're in, most of them are white. And a fair amount are middle class. Working class people are relatively not well represented. And as we probably all of us know, hopefully you should know, you know, if you're a different color, a different ethnicity, a different nationality of everybody else, it's sometimes difficult to come into a situation. It can be uncomfortable. But more so if the teachers are talking about the Dharma and implying that, you know, through their little examples or, you know, about us and us and us, you know, and it's talking about examples that have only reference to, you know, their own particular niche, their own particular group, people don't feel comfortable about that. And so there's a lot of vitality, a lot of interest now to have, to raise this issue up, a diversity issue in the Buddhist circles. And Spirit Rock, there's a very vital group of people who are coming up with all kinds of ideas and suggestions and putting on retreats and challenging the teachers. And in fact, teachers had a meeting with the Diversity Council of Spirit Rock on September 10th of 2001 that was apparently quite strong. And then we're going to do it again on January 27th. They said, "We have to meet with you some more, because there's things we need to work to tell you." And there's a wonderful man named, or I don't know, I've never met him, but filmmaker named Lee Man Hua, who produced a great movie called, the first movie called The Color of Fear, which we showed here some years ago, about 5-6 years ago. I was concerned about this issue of diversity and how it plays out in our community. So we had a day-long event on a Saturday. We showed his movie, and we had a facilitator who was trained by Lee Man Hua to come and talk about diversity in our group. And some of you, I think, were there. And now he has a new film called Last Chance for Eden, is what it's called. And he's going to have a showing at Spirit Rock, I believe. Did it just happen, or is it happening?
This Sunday.
This Saturday or Sunday? Sunday? What?
I think it's
2 p.m. 2 p.m. is during the day? Anyway, he's going to be there showing his film. And if it's as powerful as the first film, I think everybody should see it. And I'll try to see if we can get it down here, get a copy and have it show it down here. And so this whole issue of diversity, of course, is something which is very confusing for American society. It's certainly a lot of pain involved. And, you know, it's very confusing for me. And I've tried over the years to somehow certainly think about it, but address it a little bit. And still uncertain about how we as a group, and now, especially now we have a center, and I feel even more responsible about how we hold ourselves and how awake, aware, sensitive, mindful we are of causes and conditions that we live in and how we act and our intentions, our blindness. It seems all in the spirit of Dharma practice. So I'm going back then to, I went off on some long tangents here, or long, to come back in. So Spirit Rock and other places had these archetypes and Mahayana figures and mythological figures, women. And I thought it was fine. It was quite inspiring in many ways. But I thought the Theravada tradition that we're part of is kind of a, it's an ordinary tradition. It's known by the other people as the lesser vehicle, and which is a kind of a derogatory. But, you know, we're kind of happy to take that. We're happy to be lesser, and that's what, you know, and be ordinary, and, you know, not be as great, and that's fine, you know. Not have the problems that come with greatness, and and you know, most of us are kind of conceited anyway, so it kind of helps our conceit to be told, you know, you're lesser. So it's, you know, it helps us. They do that, so we're happy for that. And but it's kind of like more ordinary tradition. It's more kind of down to earth kind of thing, and doesn't have much emphasis on, you know, gods and celestial figures and bodhisattvas, and it's kind of like reality as it is, and learning how to be present for it, seeing it as it is, and discovering the spiritual realm in the reality as it actually is, rather than kind of some flights of mystic fancy. Not that Mahayana is that way, but but I guess I said the wrong thing. So you have to be very sensitive to what you say. You can't relax. And,
can't win.
But it's okay. It's okay because I'm a Zen Buddhist priest also. So I'm talking about us, me. So I thought it'd be, you know, really good for us to have a historical person to hold that role as a female role model for that possibility, to kind of hold that possibility of women as practitioners, women as teachers. And so the statue that Lorraine has made is a statue of Mahapajapati teaching. And that's in juxtaposition, in a sense, to the silencing of women's voices down through history. And we don't know. We know very little about the great women teachers who have existed down through the centuries, the life of women, of nuns. And in fact, the nuns' order died out in Buddhism, in Theravadan Buddhism around the 13th century, and no longer exists in its original form. And Lorraine went to see Ajahn Sundara, this Theravadan. She's called a nun, but she's not really technically a nun. But she's, we treat her as a nun. She came to teach with here in our center earlier last year. When she was here, Lorraine, the artist, went to see her to see what a Buddhist nun looks like and talked to her about it. And Lorraine was very, Ajahn Sundara was very clear that you know, enlightened women, nuns, are always very composed, you know, very composed in themselves, very settled, concentrated, centered, and felt the statue should be that way. But Lorraine, taking artistic license, didn't share that view. And so what she created was a statue that's actually leaning forward quite a bit. It's not composed in the sense of being balanced, but it's leaning forward. And has her hands in a teaching mudra. And her mouth is a little bit open. And I love it because it's kind of like, for me, I don't know what Lorraine was thinking about, but for me it represents this woman who's leaning forward into the world and has some passion or some interest, some dedication, some involvement with reaching forward to teach people to help and to teach and kind of in the world rather than removed from it or held back. And then she's teaching, her mouth is open and she's teaching. And, you know, again, in contrast to historically what at times has been the silencing of women's voices in Buddhism, and certainly in other places too. It's is not inherently a problem of Buddhism. It just and so I hope that the statue will inspire us all about the possibility of ordinary human beings becoming free and liberated. Sometimes the Buddha seems a little bit too much for us to emulate. And I hope that Mapa Japati also then becomes a representative of the many, many women who are disciples of the Buddha, who became renunciants, who became enlightened, either as nuns or as lay people. And there were many of them. And we have actually the records of a good number of them, of what they taught and what they said, and a little bit about their lives. And it's quite touching to read the lives of these women and their suffering they had to address, and the women who lost their only child, or lost their husband, or lost their whole family died, and the grief of that. And sometimes it's a bit easier to enter the spiritual life when you have that kind of loss, because your deepest attachment has been taken away from you. And so that, you know, it gives a kind of a freedom then, because the worst has already happened. It's easier to let go further then. And there are stories of women who were prostitutes, and then there were stories of women who were courtesans, being much higher level, very respectable kind of prostitutes of the times. And all kinds of stories about, these stories of these women. There's one story I read today of a woman who was a nun for 25 years. And she writes, in those 25 years, every thought I've had is about sex. You know, she's celibate, right? For 25 years, what pain. So she's kind of, it's pain, you know. And but then the end of the poem is, it describes her enlightenment. She finally gets free. She sets free. And so it's beautiful stories of freedom. Some of the stories of freedom kind of don't quite, there's not often a good match for kind of what we think spirituality is about necessarily, but you have to kind of understand the context and what it meant. There's one kind of nice one, I think it's kind of cute. Think of it what you want, but she says, she's so happy and she's become free. She says, I'm free at last. Free of three things, the mortar, the pestle, and that old husband of mine. So who knows what her life was like, but so and then at the last thing I'll say kind of is that so at the Zen Center in San Francisco, coming from a Chinese tradition a lot, in Chinese culture, honoring the ancestors is very important. And so one of the things that happened in Buddhism in China, much more than in India and other places, lineage became very important. And chanting the lineage from yourself back to the Buddha, from the Buddha to you, is what they do every day. And so, for example, I have this lineage paper, because I was ordained in the Zen tradition, that traces the lineage, called the blood lineage, from the Buddha down through the centuries, from one person to the next. Buddha gave the transmission to Ma Kashyapa. Ma Kashyapa gave it to Ananda. Ananda gave it to, you know, it goes down to Nagarjuna and Bodhidharma and then Master Dogen and down through the ages. And some of it's just mythological. They just made it up because the Chinese wanted to have a lineage chart. But historically, I'm inspired by the idea of it, that Buddhism is handed down from warm hand to warm hand, that Buddhism passed down from, you know, the living contact of one person to the other. And the fact that there were this lineage paper that I have is there's about 92 people in it in the line lineage, and there's probably about that number of people here in this room. So that's how many people separate us from the Buddha. Isn't that kind of, I think that's quite something. It's not very far away, and it makes it much closer. So at the Zen Center they chant this lineage, and about some years ago they said, wait a minute, these are all guys. And they felt kind of stuck because, you know, you can't just kind of invent, unless you're Chinese, you know. See, did I blow it? For that kind of statement, I apologize. But anyway, it's a little bit harder in the modern world where we have, are much more have scholarly criticism. Scholarly, you know, in the best sense of the term, it's hard to just kind of invent things. And, we can't just kind of invent a living lineage that goes back to the Buddha for women. So what they did at Zen Center was, they didn't do that, but what they did was they took all the names of all the enlightened women who were disciples of the Buddha, and they made that into a chant that they do, I think, most mornings. And they just chant those names. And I think we'll do that as part of the ceremony, is we'll chant those names of all those women. So those women are still, even though they lived 2,500 years ago, their names have not been forgotten. Some of their stories have not been forgotten. And the examples that they attained the ultimate goal that Buddhism points to is not forgotten. And my hope is that in all this, that we become a center, a community, that we are a center and community, where no matter who comes through the door, they will find that they'll be inspired, that they too, if they wish, can follow the path of practice to becoming fully free. So it is 9 o'clock. What I'd like to ask for you is your patience for maybe 5 minutes or so. And I'd like to, because I don't know how this was for some of you, and I would like to have a chance for some of you to respond to what I've said so far. And maybe I'm not going to respond in return much because of the limit of time, but if some of you would like just to say, you know, response to something troubled you that I said or seemed inappropriate or some comments. Yes? The 24th, so the following. And I've invited, there's about half a dozen or so women teachers who I've invited to come and be part of it, that event. Yes?
I remember that you were assigned to, by, I think it was Jack Kornfield, to do a little book of something about women's teachers.
Right.
Can you tell us about that again?
The story, I think I might have told a story some years ago that I don't remember so well anymore, but there's a little book that I helped Jack edit called Teachings of the Buddha. I did a lot of the work for it. He hired me to do it, and so that's kind of how I did it. And at some point, I was horrified to realize that it was all guys again. Because it wasn't just teachings of the Buddha, it was actually all kinds of teachings down through the history of Buddhism. Of different teachers and stuff. And it was all these male teachers. So when I realized that, I very quickly went back to Jack and said, we can't do this. and then try to find out some way to include some of the voices of the women. And so there is some now in the book.
Is the book available still?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
I gave one to the library, so it's probably...
And some of these poems of the early Buddhist women are in that book. Yes?
Since you were asking about how we feel, this is not the first time that I had heard Buddha's response. And for me, it's at the emotional level, it is disappointing. And it's not only Buddhism, so it kind of I get this feeling of kind of keeping away from all religions because of this gender-specific attitude that's in Catholicism and Islam and in all religions. You see that, so it gives me a very
she says she's very uncomfortable and wants to stay away from religions because. It seems so prevalent in religions, some way in which the doors are closed to women. And now in Buddhism also, in some ways, hearing the story of the Buddha. And there are different interpretations of this story. It sounds on the surface. Remember I said he didn't actually say no? He just said enough? So, you know, is that just a polite way of saying no? There are different interpretations, and one of them is I'm not very satisfied with these interpretations. But one of the classic interpretations is that saying enough was meant specific. Buddha was not saying And so for example, the tradition, which elevates the Buddha to being almost omniscient, will say the Buddha knew that he was going to have a nun's order. Because he did have it. He wasn't going to do something he didn't know he was not going to do. Did I say, is that confused? But his saying enough was specifically to Ma Pajapati, that she was a queen, she was used to getting her way and whatever, that if he had said yes to her too soon, that she needed to be somehow humbled or something, or be willing to kind of something. So it was kind of, he was saying no to her temporarily in order to kind of humble her, I suppose. So when she'd come back the second time, I guess, and ask again, that then, she'd come in a much more humble state. So that's not a very satisfying interpretation, but there are different interpretations. And people like to believe the Buddha was not misogynist or wasn't against women in any kind of way. And certainly he had a lot of women disciples, and he spoke very highly of his women, some of the women in his circles, and certainly respected their capacity not only to become enlightened but to become teachers. And he did, allow for the nun's order to happen at some point. But then down through the history of Buddhism, certainly there's been a lot of doors closed to women, and women treated as second-class citizens and in the Buddhism and stuff like that. And hopefully we don't see that as inherent in the practice and in the profound teachings the Buddha gave, but rather has to do with the social conditions, the cultural conditions that we all, live in, and some of them which we're still probably blind to. Someone over here?
Well, yeah. You sort of responded back then. I was going to ask if there are any interpretations that mitigated the conditions of seeing as onerous as the enough statements.
The other thing that's been said about this is that back in ancient India, conditions were much harder for women in all kinds of ways. And for women to be renunciants wandering around alone in India without any kind of protection, some people think was kind of unheard of. It was kind of like no one in the right mind thought this was a safe thing for people to do. And I saw that in Thailand to this day, where one very famous monastery in the jungles where I stayed, in Buddhadasa's monastery, the men had these little kutis, little huts deep in the jungle. It's very nice to go off in the jungle and be by yourself. And the women had to stay in this compounded area that had this fence and barbed wire around it. And it was explained that it was simply not safe for the women to be out in the jungle by themselves. And in fact, there was a lot of problems there. There was, we regularly had our little cooties broken into and things stolen. Even though the doors were locked, there was a lot of theft and a lot of violence in the area. So there was some feeling it wasn't safe for the nuns there to, they had to kind of be protected. So the Buddha, part of his reluctance had to do with that. And part of those conditions, those rules, had to do with the cultural conditions of the time and what was acceptable. Yes, please.
What about the teachings? Can you say something about the teachings lasting 500 years versus 1,000?
Yeah. And so either we have the counterfeit version these days, or the Theravada tradition itself, then I haven't studied these texts, but the commentaries much later, after 1,000 years, try to explain how this can be, that the teachings still continue and the Buddha was somehow, because the Buddha is never wrong, so what, how did that work out? I don't know those explanations, but I do know that if you study the history of Buddhism, it was relatively common to have a prophecy for how long Buddhism would last. And so there was like the 500-year prophecy because of this woman thing. And then there became, after 500 years, there suddenly these mysterious texts arose that said it actually was going to be 1,000 years. And then at some point, after a few more centuries went on, it became 2,500 years or 5,000 years. And so it's very convenient. Religious people find very convenient ways of you find in a cave, or you have this revelation, and you know things are set right again. So it's very interesting how the progression of the 500, 1,000, 5,000, how long the Dharma will last. And there's very complicated teachings around this 500-year thing. One idea is that after 500 years, there's the Dharma lasts only its purity for 500 years, and then it begins to kind of decay for 500 years. Then that gives you 1,000 years. And then another 500 years, it's the counterfeit Dharma. That's the word. So it's a 1,500-year cycle. But then the question of the people in old time Asia was, from when do you start counting? Because they didn't have the same kind of interest in chronology as we do, especially coming out of India. And so there's various calculations of when the counterfeit Dharma was going to start. It turned out for Japanese Buddhism, this was a big thing. And they decided at some point by the 1200s, that they were living in the age of the counterfeit Dharma. And this was a time when the practice was no longer efficacious, that no one could practice anymore in order to become enlightened. It simply wasn't possible anymore. And so then there was various, this is a very important teachings in Komakura, Japan. And so then various schools of thought arose in Japanese Buddhism to counter that idea. And one of them is kind of somewhat of a Lutheran view of liberation by grace. Yes, it's true. You cannot become enlightened anymore. You can't practice. You can't self-power, using your own abilities to become enlightened. It's no longer available to you. So what you have to rely on is what they called other power, Tariki in Japanese. And other power was this celestial Buddha called Amida Buddha. That you had to you couldn't do it through good works. You had to chant his name, but you couldn't chant his name in order to get saved. You just had to chant his name in pure faith, and then through his grace you would be saved. So grace rather than good works. Does that sound familiar? Those of you who are Lutherans. So Buddhism is quite complex. And a lot of different strategies, a lot of different responses to causes and conditions of its time. And here we are in Redwood City, in the peninsula, with our own causes and conditions and our time and place. And my hope is that we try to become as mindful and aware of all the causes and conditions and all the conditioning that is present for us as practitioners, including that which is unseen to date, that which was invisible to us. So may the invisible become visible for the well-being of all beings, so that all people may be happy and free. Thank you.